Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Copernic Global Investors' first quarter 2021 conference call. As a reminder, today's call is being recorded. At the conclusion of today's presentation, there will be a question and answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. At this time, I would like to turn the call over to Mr. Qasem Ghaffar. Please go ahead, Mr. Ghaffar.
Thank you, operator, and welcome to the first quarter 2021 conference call. My name is Qasem Ghaffar, and I have with me David Ibin, our CIO and Portfolio Manager for the Copernic Global All-Cap Strategy and Co-PM for the International Strategy, and also Alisa Cochrane, our Director of Research and Analyst. Before I pass the call to Dave and Alisa for the bulk of the call, I'll be providing a quick business update. The firm entered the first quarter with overall firm assets of roughly $6.2 billion. This was a nice increase from the beginning of the year, where the assets grew by roughly $1 billion over the previous three months due to strong inflows and market appreciation. As you can imagine, given our current portfolio composition and due to recent uptick in appetite for value-oriented managers, we have seen an increase in search activity. With this increase, as you may be aware, we soft closed our Global All-Cap Mutual Fund effective March 31st, 2021. However, in addition to our international fund, which is available for new investors, we do have other vehicles still open for new clients for our Global All-Cap Strategy. Moving along on the personnel side, no changes to report, and we ended the quarter 39 employees strong and continue to be stable with minimal turnover since inception of the firm. Please note, Dave and Alisa will be referring to the presentation, which can be found on our website, copernicglobal.com, under the News and Views section. Also, we do have some new content, including our recent ESG webinar, which was very well received by our audience, and some great new thoughtful pieces that we have posted to our website. We encourage everyone to have a look at their convenience. With that, I'll pass it over to Dave. Dave, please go ahead.
All right. Thanks, Qasem, and thanks to everybody for joining us. It's been quite an eventful quarter, so we have a lot of pages, but don't worry, we'll go through them really quickly. Anyhow, our message, I think it's mostly an upbeat message, especially for active management, but we must mention, the world does seem a bit crazy lately, doesn't it? It presents a lot of significant risks that are different from what most of us have seen in our lifetimes. Certainly, we haven't seen this sort of monetary or fiscal policy in our lifetime. This makes things especially dangerous. The crazier the market, the better it is for active managers. With maybe the craziest market ever, we think the opportunities right now are exceptionally good for active managers. On the surface, things are good for everybody. This is the age of abundance. Yeah, couldn't help but be reminded of Billie Eilish's song, "I Had a Dream, I Got Everything I Wanted." It sure seems for investors that we have everything we want. It seems like politicians, academics, everybody has everything they want. On the surface, very good. Certainly, the central bankers are committed to us always having everything we want. They have said they will do whatever it takes, and Powell, Draghi, you name it, Lagarde, the Spanish, the British, the Italians, the French, the Japanese, the Chinese, every central banker on Earth have promised us that we can have abundance forever. They will do whatever it takes. Pretty much the academics say that this is okay. They can do this. There is no side effects. There is no cost. All of our dreams can come true. Certainly, the MMT advocates talk about the deficit myth. We don't need to worry about the deficits. We also don't have to worry about the money creation. Governments can just create money, and we shouldn't have to work. It's the age of UBI. Valuations, of course, don't matter when a stock has momentum. As we're told, the sky is the limit. If we just see ourselves living in abundance, we will. It is that easy, and thus far, it looks like it's true. Look at the results. We're talking nonstop drop in volatility with occasional spikes, but not much volatility left. we're talking 4 decades, my entire career, of interest rates pretty much going nowhere but down. They're very low in many parts of the world. They don't exist anymore. There are no rates of interest. The same 4 decades, we've seen stocks only go up and real estate go up and almost everything else go up. So everyone everywhere is participating in this free money. This is Utopia. And that concludes our presentation. Just kidding. There's obviously more to go. So let's go back to Billie Eilish's song, I Had a Dream, I Got Everything I Wanted. She continues, not what you'd think. If I'm being honest, it might have been a nightmare. That brings to mind the Twilight Zone episode read about in Grant Williams' wonderful Things That Make You Go Home. Anybody that doesn't have his research should look into it. But episode 28, A Nice Place to Visit, where the bad guys he dies in a shooting after a robbery, and he wakes up in a special place. A guy dressed in white takes him in, puts him in a beautiful home, beautiful meals. He starts to get whatever he wants, wine woman song, gambling, always wins, continues to win. He's enjoying it, but as the episode goes on, it starts to dawn on him that maybe this isn't so good. At the end, it becomes clear this isn't heaven, as they put it. This is the other place. So where are we now? I think in the school of Austrian economics and most classical economics, people will say, yeah, we can have all this stuff, but there is a cost to everything. We've always bought off on their notion that there ain't no such thing as a free lunch. So what are the consequences to what's been going on? Overvaluation. To the left, we see PE is about as expensive as we've ever seen. Price to GDP is far and away the most expensive market in the history of our country. Price to sales, even more so. We can show price to replacement value, to cash flow, to book values, to anything. This is the most expensive market ever. So that's at least a concern. Secondly, printing money, by definition, is inflation. And here you can see the quick doubling of money. So we've pretty much had 100% implicit money supply growth, thus inflation, since 2007. It's up 9 times, I think. So a lot of money has been printed. But people say, fine, but there's been no inflation. Well, there has been inflation. Where have the symptoms gone? They have not gone to CPI. But we all know that NASDAQ's gone up 7 or 8 times with it. Real estate prices have gone up. Lumber's just doubled. Metals are up. Drugs are up. Most things that matter to us are up substantially in price and probably will continue to keep going up. So inflation is here. When I came into business, interest rates were really high and nobody thought inflation could be stopped. They were wrong. Now, interest rates are very negative in real terms, and nobody thinks inflation can come back. It's here. It's going to get worse. Third thing is inequality. I think most economists have argued for a long, long time that printing money always has been and will be a cause of inequality. The money printing almost always goes first into the price of assets. Rich people own assets. They make money. The people further away from the money supply, they get stuck without the asset increases, but they deal with the increasing cost of living. So that, it's no coincidence, has gotten a lot worse for the last 15 years. Right now, it seems with all the free money, borrowing is not a bad thing. So everybody's borrowing. Corporations, once again, are right back at it. Governments, we've all seen that everywhere, but just the U.S., if anybody has not ever logged on to the usdebtclock.org, it's fascinating. It's depressing to watch how fast these numbers go up by the tenth of a second, but already every taxpayer in the U.S. implicitly owes $366,000. It's not going to be easy to pay off. So something to watch. Charlie Munger, show me an incentive, I'll show the outcome. How about we incentivize people not to work? So we're now paying people a lot of money to not work. You've seen anybody that takes Uber seen that now it's harder to get an Uber and it costs a lot more. The Uber can't get people to want to drive a car when they can get paid a few thousand to sit at home. Restaurants, bars, other things, they're having a lot of trouble getting people to come in. So that's one of the. Another consequence, and we've seen this everywhere, is wild speculation. So it's really been phenomenal. I've always been a student of financial history, but I've never seen or even read about anything like this except for maybe tulips in Holland, although this might equal that, and then some. And when you can get paid a lot of money to speculate, there again, why go to work? Why be a businessman? Why run an enterprise when you can get your check and speculate on Robin Hood? And this shows the more speculative, the better, the more money you make. It simply looks to be that easy. And it spawns wild ideas. NFTs are fascinating. So a picture of a portrait on a cell phone is worth $69 million, or at least was. So it's all going to be interesting to watch. So with the governments and the central banks in charge, what could possibly go wrong? Basically, it looks like we're in an infinite loop. Once you start printing money, von Mises tells you there is no stopping. And certainly the central banks have learned that if printing money causes a disaster, the thing to take away from that is they didn't print enough money. And so with each time they're printing more and more money, that has consequences. And so, Billy Eilish might be right. The central bankers might have wake up to find it was a nightmare they created. But let's, with that out of the way, this is actually in good news in many ways for active managers. Switching from Billy Eilish to the Rolling Stones, I think the central banks are going to find they can't get what they want. But I think active managers, if they look hard and are willing to break away from the crowd, will find they get what they need. And that's what we're going to spend the rest of this time talking about. Rather than mindlessly going with what's working, let's do rigorous analysis. Let's search for the truth. The volatility that's being created is a good thing for investors instead of a risky thing for it. Why intangibles certainly are very valuable, maybe tangibles still have values. So we believe that society is kind of the opposite of where it was when I came into business, is people have a different idea on thrift and on savings and on hard work and on economic policy and debt and inflation. Maybe people's portfolios should be positioned the opposite of how they ought to have been 40 years ago. So that's, of course, what we think. We think the whole Hayek versus Keynes was a great book, if anybody hasn't read it. It's interesting, two contemporaries that knew each other and kind of admired and fought it out with each other. But is the government able to fix everything and make it better, as Keynes said? And are there formulas for everything? Or are the Austrian school more right, really you should leave it up to the private market, and there are repercussions to everything. I'm a huge Mass fan myself, but I think Charlie Munger and F.A. Hayek are correct. Mathematics cannot usurp logic or common sense. So anybody that hasn't read Hayek ought to. Anybody wants to have a little fun, this video from, 10, 12 years ago, hear the boom and the bust. It's kind of a fun watch. Anyhow, I think that active managers should side with Hayek and position themselves to benefit from the inevitable consequences. So if the current school of thought is wrong, maybe they shouldn't be looking for stability. What if stability is in fact unstable? What if people should be going long volatility instead of trying to suppress it? Maybe people should be buying scarce assets instead of buying things that are not scarce, whether it's a money supply that's doubled or debt that's growing at unbelievable rates or NFTs that are popping up left and right or SPACs that are maybe things that are not scarce become less valuable, and we should be looking for scarce things, preferably scarce things that meet needs that people need. So that's where we are. If the world is cyclical and financial assets and passive investing is what was working in the old world, what about the new paradigm? Where are we at? We agree that passive is great in many ways, cheaper fees, but maybe people are getting what they're paying for. Maybe it's worth a little money to have somebody research and make decisions instead of following the crowd. Where indexing is cheap. Look how it works. Look at this Tesla chart. Guess where the indexers bought. I mean, it wasn't exactly the peak, but pretty close. Indexers 20 years ago, their biggest holding by far was GE. And it was about three times as big as the number two holding. After 20 years of torture, GE was kicked out of the index, and the indexers, some of them had to sell, not quite at the bottom, but pretty well near the bottom. So, maybe people should try to position themselves counter-cyclically after a dozen years of momentum working. What goes up comes down, and vice versa. Maybe keep that Tesla chart in mind as we go to the next slide here. Where is Tesla on this? Anyhow, active investing has allowed Copernic to keep our heads well above water during a horrible decade for everything of value. Almost all forms of value have had a bad time, but volatility and active management have allowed us to take advantage of that. And talking a little bit about how we do it, why we do that, why it's worked, and why it makes us feel pretty good about the future, let's hand things over to our Director of Research, Lisa Corcoran.
Thanks, Dave. Yeah, we're going to go through a couple examples of where we've used volatility, active management to our advantage, and how it's helped our returns. One area in particular is utilities. We've owned emerging market utilities for many years, since inception. 2014, 2015, we had a very large position in Electrobras, which is the blue line. The company was trading at 10% of book value, 4% of replacement cost. We had a 4% position in this company. As you can see, the Electrobras went up six times in a year. And in passive investing, this would have meant that now that's a larger percentage of the portfolio. For us, we trimmed along the way. We reduced our model weight. By August of 2019, our model weight was 1.5%. At the same time, as we're trimming Electrobras, we were buying more of EDF, buying more of Rus Hydro, buying more of Federal Grid. So as you can see, with the exception of Electrobras, emerging market utilities have gone nowhere. And despite this fact, we've made double-digit returns in emerging market utilities. So utilities is one area. Other areas that have basically done nothing, but we've been able to make strong returns. Emerging markets, Russia, materials and energy, they have contributed very strongly to our returns, yet they've done virtually, they've added nothing to the ACWI, which is our benchmark. It's important to note that these numbers are contribution. If you look at the annualized returns, they're much larger than that. In all of these areas, we've made double-digit returns. This is not bragging. This is more to say that active management, if you can keep your head above water during the bad times, you know, that sets you up very well to do well in the future and during the good times. Other examples, gold mining companies, just looking over the last 14 months, we were buying in the first quarter. We bought a lot when gold miners collapsed. They fell almost in half despite the fact that gold really was, you know, not down very much at all. And then we were using the price appreciation to trim. We trimmed all the way through the summer and then bought again as they've been falling pretty much every day since August. Because of this, our annualized returns are more than four times larger than what you would have gotten if you had just owned the GDX. So using volatility to our advantage has been important for us. Uranium mining is the same story. This is an area we have owned since 2013. Unfortunately, uranium has, until recently, gone the wrong direction for 8 years. Today, Dogecoin has a market cap that's larger than the entire uranium mining market cap. So despite the fact that uranium miners have fallen from 35 to 18, we have had a positive contribution. We've done this by keeping our conviction, maintaining our patience, adding new names as the uranium mining companies have fallen. Oil is the same story. This is the Russell Energy Index. And we really didn't own very much oil, but we have added names as the oil companies have fallen. We added a significant position in Cenovus right, you know, as oil is collapsing in March of 2020. We all remember the negative 40 oil price. Again, oil down, contribution for Copernic positive. Natural gas is also an area that we didn't own in inception. Gazprom is a name we've held since inception, but it's more of a hybrid gas-oil name. So until really 2015, when we added Consol, we didn't own natural gas. We waited for it to fall 80%. And then we waited again. We didn't own another one until 3 years later when we added Range, and then added Southwestern even later on. This tells the same story. Natural gas companies collapsed. Our contribution has been positive because we've been very disciplined with our valuation process, disciplined, trimming and adding as our positions have, as the price has fallen and risen. Copper mining, we've mostly owned Turquoise Hill and Ivanhoe. Over the past 14 months, they've been beautifully volatile, as you can see in this chart here. We've been mostly buying for the first 9 months of 2020. We were buying as we were trimming our gold names. As you can remember, in the summer, we were trimming our gold companies. And then at the same time, when Ivanhoe goes up, we would trim that. And if it were going up while Turquoise fell, we would sell Ivanhoe, buy more Turquoise, and vice versa. So what we're trying to communicate is that while we've had positive returns in many of these commodity stocks that have fallen, our thesis has really not played out. Many of the commodities that we own are still trading well below their incentive price. We expect the commodity to rise significantly, and also the mining companies that have the commodity in the ground to rise significantly more. Further, while we don't need inflation for our commodity stocks to do well, inflation has happened, as Dave pointed out. The money supply has gone up 9 times since 2008, yet copper, oil, gold, platinum, silver, they're all much lower than they were in 2011. As this chart shows, these sorts of stocks should do well in a rising inflationary environment. Raw materials do well, precious metals, mining companies. So from our standpoint, active management using volatility to our advantage has helped keep our head above water during the times when commodities have not done well, when value has not done well. And if we see inflation start making its way into commodities, which we're just recently starting to see, we'll have the wind at our back. And for those who believe that they've missed the reflation trade, this chart should make you think again. They are still extremely cheap relative to the S&P. And despite the fact that many of these commodities have gone up, this just shows how cheap they actually were. Gold, in particular, is one of our favorite areas, despite the fact that we have seen a lot of money printing. Gold is effectively flat over the last decade, and gold miners are down significantly. If you look back even further, back in 2011, this would show, you know, even greater magnitude. Many of these gold mining stocks are down 50, 60% since 2011. So to go over some of the changes in the portfolio, I will turn it back to Dave.
All right, thank you. All right, so clearly volatility that many people think is risk is actually opportunity. Historically, we've had low volatility, but it picked up a lot in 2002 and 3, which was very helpful to us. Picked up a lot in 08 and 9, which is very helpful to us. And it picked up a lot last year in that wildly volatile time we had last year. Volatility was our friend, is our friend. As you can see here in the net reduced column, quite a few reductions. Resource companies, inflation beneficiaries, emerging market companies, companies that we were able to buy at very distressed levels a year ago, less than a year ago. So that we're happy with. On added to, while we're selling some resources, we're able to buy other resources that have come down. So this is a wonderful thing. As Elisa mentioned, when people didn't like copper last year, we bought the gold companies that had a lot of copper. Now we've been trimming them because they're up a lot and buying back the ones that don't have as much copper that have fallen down. We've been able to take advantage over the last year of different conglomerates. People in the 1960s were paying huge premiums for conglomerates. Now they're selling them at half price. They don't like the idea of bundling a few companies together. So that's nice. Even had a consumer name with Carrefour, which has gotten pretty cheap lately. Global, international, same story. Volatility has been helpful, and we think will continue to be. But you know, we are excited that the upside is really good for companies that have assets. It's really good for inflation beneficiaries. It's probably pretty good for emerging markets and whatnot. But we don't want people to have the wrong impression. Pretty balanced portfolio. The traditional side is also a lot of value. You can see things that we're buying at half of book value with really nice dividends. We're talking consumer communication services. So oligopolies and phone business, what could be much better than the phone business nowadays? Half a book, almost 5% dividend yield. Financials, not something we've owned a lot of historically, but we've been able to buy them lately. Discounts to book value, 4% yields. Utilities, we'll need to talk to you a little bit about that. But we're talking utilities that have, in general, pretty low variable costs, that have next to no inflation, that have no greenhouse gases. We're talking hydroelectric, we're talking nuclear, in many cases in growing economies. Monopolies was something that people need that has a competitive advantage. At less than half a book and 3.5% of yield. So when you add it all together, we have a balanced portfolio of wonderful tangible value and optionality combined with great, great franchises, the quality companies that people like. And when you put it together, the valuations are fairly attractive in an absolute sense. They're extremely attractive relative to the market. If there is no inflation whatsoever, this portfolio is well situated. If the inevitable inflation comes, it is very well situated. So good companies, attractive valuations, and as the central banks continue to sow the seeds of future volatility, we say we're getting very encouraged that the never-ending cycle back and forth from passive investing to active is handing the baton to active. So that's what we see, and we're happy to spend most of the time on Q&A. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, the floor is open for your questions. If you would like to ask a question, you may do so now by pressing star 1 on your touch-tone phone. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure that your mute function is disabled to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 now. And our first question comes from Dana Lambert with Morgan Stanley.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Great. Just looking at the valuations across a lot of your portfolio where there are commodity producers owned, just curious how the valuations relative to the underlying commodity tend to look versus their historical range. And so, you know, when you compare, you know, for instance, in precious metals, I know a lot of the miners are trading at pretty low multiples and certainly very low levels relative to the underlying metal. But curious about some of the other sectors, if those two are sort of trading well below their range. I know the company itself may have a pretty interesting valuation based on traditional metrics, but just versus the what they produce, curious what you're seeing.
Yeah, what we're seeing is it's interesting. We, you know, we like it when we have views that are quite different than the market does on how we should look at things. And here we do. And so, and you know, if we can be right half the time, three quarters of the time, it works out very, very well. How to value these things, there's different ways and people can argue for things. How not to value these things, we think, is on last year's cash flow or last year's earnings. We like to say if we pull out a coin, a gold coin, say what's this worth, and we can all agree $1,800 plus or minus, and we dig a hole in the ground and we throw it in and bury it and say what's it worth now, what is last quarter's cash flow? That has nothing to do with it. Last quarter's earnings have nothing to do with it. It is still worth $1,800 minus the cost of digging it up. And so we figure, you know, it's worth that. Now on Wall Street and Bay Street, people say, nah, it's in the ground, you know, we'll sell it to you for $1,000 adjusted for all the costs. We say we're a buyer. We like that. Now it's not simple, so we look at it lots of ways. We say, what's it worth now? Well, $1,800 is what it's worth now. So we look at that as an input. We say, over the long term, you run out of supply of something unless the price is high enough to make people build mines. With gold, it's for a long time been at least $2,000. So you'll probably notice there's some small mines being built, but nowhere near fast enough to stop the existing mines from depleting themselves. So sustainability will require a price of $2,000 or more, so we value it at $2,000 as well as at $1,800. That's obviously a better number. That obviously gives us some pretty good upside. Then we say, well, you know, the dollar used to be backed by gold, and through history, eventually we come back to that. Under Bretton Woods, Each dollar is pretty much backed by, quarter way backed by gold. In 1980, it was 100%. You could have more than fully backed all the dollars with the gold. Actually, gold was worth a lot more. Now there's been this tenfold increase in money supply. So if they wanted to go back to Bretton Woods and somewhat back it, now we're talking many thousands of dollars. And so, we don't pay for optionality. We like free optionality. If gold's worth 1,800, we think these stocks are selling below that. They could liquidate. We make money. We make pretty decent money at 2,000, and there's free optionality that maybe gold is worth thousands of dollars. And so we really like that. Even more exciting is some of the other things we have. Whereas gold is at a couple hundred dollars from its all-time high, uranium was $137 a pound back in 2007, somewhere like that. It fell to 18, and for years now it's been bouncing between 18 and 35. We believe, talking to a lot of people, that somewhere in the $60 to $90 range is the price that would be required to get people to start building mines, that incentive price. Now, people are building nuclear reactors a lot faster than they're closing them down. China in particular is building a lot of them. Japan seems to be headed back in that direction of reopening. So all these multi-billion-dollar reactors need uranium. Uranium inventories were obscenely high after Fukushima. They've been dropping for a dozen years. They're now getting dangerously low. They're going to need to start building mines. They are not building mines at $30 uranium. They're doing the opposite. At $30 uranium, Kazakhstan has cut back supply a couple times. And Cameco, 3-4 years back, shut their biggest mine, and it is still shut. A couple of times they've shut their next best mine. The Chinese have shut a few big mines. People are setting up funds just to buy and hold uranium. So it's not even debatable that $30 is way too low a price, whether it's 60 or 90 or 100 something. Smart people can debate that. But at any rate, we think these companies are selling too cheaply. And if it hits 60, massive upside. If it's 90, these will be very, very attractive. Natural gas has bounced between $2 and $14 most of my career. It's at the lower end of that range. People really, really hate hydrocarbons right now. They may go away in the next half century or century, but it's not easy to get off of hydrocarbons. And natural gas is the cleanest of the hydrocarbons. It's also abundant and very cheap in the U.S. And if we do go to electric cars, most of that incremental demand is going to have to be met by gas. You can only build so much solar and so much wind. We're probably not going back to coal. We're definitely not going back to oil for electricity generation. It's going to be natural gas. So there again, we've tended to own companies with very long fields that are okay at current prices, but if prices go up another dollar, then there's really nice value to these companies. And if it ever gets back to the high end of its old range, then massive money. Copper now is doubled off the bottom, so it's less attractive than it was, but the copper stocks, they still have some value, we believe. So, it's not a matter of us liking or not liking commodities. We like commodities that, one, are selling below that incentive price that it would take to keep supply going, two, are valued by mankind and generally needed, and three, sell cheaper on the stock market than the spot market. And so we very much like natural gas and uranium and gold and silver and platinum.
Thank you. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star one now. Speakers, at this time, we have no further questioners in the queue.
Well, okay. Maybe just mentioning volatility scared people up, but anyhow, we certainly appreciate everybody dialing on, and we look forward to the coming quarter, and we'll talk to you again in 3 months. Thank you very much.